You're tuned in to the Big Buck Theory. This week, I sat down with the co-founder of Hunt Stock. He's also the host of a successful podcast, Hunt Suburbia. He's a big buck killer and a shed picker, Pat Guyette. We're rolling right now. Mr. Pat, how you doing?
Good, Isaac. How's everything been going, brother?
It's been going good. Just working and podcasting and shed hunting and, you know, the typical March activities.
Yeah. Yep. And you found a couple of nice sheds.
Yeah, I just did. About 130 miles in, I finally found some bone.
So you're averaging one shed per 65 miles?
Yeah. I probably need a new hobby, don't you think?
Hey, dude, I just think that's a testament to how hard you got to work up here, man, to find some good antlers.
That's true. And I mean, like I was telling my buddies too, is like I was almost enjoying the fact that I wasn't finding one because it was like pushing me even harder every time I'd go out. Like I had a couple days where I was doing like, I know one day I did over 16 miles in one day, you know, and I'm just like going crazy out there, but I like the failure because it's like pushing me even harder to try to find one.
Oh yeah. And, did you just like, have you been shed hunting for months or you just get into it, you know, a few weeks ago?
Since like early February, I started walking.
Yeah.
Yeah. But so you just found some good sheds too, I see.
Yep. I've been trying to get out in between doing work, you know, if it's a rainy or a foggy afternoon or something, get out there and use the conditions to my advantage. And I found one, my best shed ever, probably about 10 days ago now, just on a quick 2-hour afternoon shed hunt, and in a spot that if I didn't find that shed, and I found the one that I ended up matching up from him. If I would have found that other one first, I would have never gone into this place where that first shed was. It was just super overlooked. Really hard to see sheds in there. There's a lot of, you know, down pines and dried out pine limbs everywhere. And when you get into an area like that, it's hard to see those antlers, hard for them to stick out. But I happened up onto it.
No kidding. Yeah. They're good at hiding, aren't they?
Yeah, and this one was upside down, which usually makes it harder. You know, the tines were sticking into the dirt.
Yep.
But it was right in the bed. You could tell it was he was right up on this little knoll and right in his bed. And I just knew right away that's a huge shed. That's not what I'm used to. I had like probably a 125-inch buck or a 120-inch buck in my hand. I'd found a smaller 4-point side a couple hours before that. And I thought that was a good one. And then it's just some of them are, you know, no doubt about it. When you see it, you're like, that's a giant. And I've been shed hunting for a couple of years and I find quite a few sheds, but I haven't found a giant. And I was looking for one, you know, that is just one of those no doubt about it sheds. And I found one. And then a few weeks later, actually, it was just maybe 4 days later. I went back out, and whenever I'm shed hunting, I use OnX religiously. Yep. And it helps me in these, you know, I kind of shed hunt by the 200 acres around here.
Yep.
And find a 200 acre patch and just try to cover it. Cause you can usually do pretty good and cover that in a day, you know, and I'll do 12 to 14 miles in a 200 acre patch of woods, just using lines. If there's a rock wall or something, you know, follow, use the rock wall as a barrier, cover one side of it, and then go to the other side. If there's a stream or something, I keep that as a barrier and just go back and forth and grid it out with the tracker feature on. And that's my strategy. It seems to work out pretty good.
Yeah, that's something that I need to start doing a little more of, is use that tracker feature on OnX, because I never turn on the tracker and I try to just like do it by feel and be like, oh, I've kind of hit this, or, you know, like when I'm trying to grid, but you know, I think let's just pause the conversation for a second and let's introduce you to the listeners. If they don't know you, you want to tell them like about yourself and where you're from and your style of hunting and all about yourself.
Yeah. Well, I'm from where you're from pretty much. We grew up in, I don't know, pretty one town over, a couple towns over.
Yeah.
I played football against your brother, but we're from the big woods of Vermont. And I moved down to the Boston area in like 2010 for work and, you know, kind of got away from my hunting roots when I moved down here. And I would go back to Vermont every weekend during the deer season, the three rifle weekends and then the two muzzleloader weekends and go to my deer camp there and, you know, still hunt, but not really hunting with a strategy or really knowing what I was doing, just picking a random spot, sitting down and shooting a buck every, you know, once every 3 years.
Right.
And, when I moved to the Boston area after about 10 years living here, when COVID hit, I was like, you know what, let me look around, you know, closer to me in the suburbs of Boston and start poking around and seeing if there's any hunting opportunities. I put some cameras out, you know, within a couple miles of my house. And I was just like blown away by the amount of deer and the bucks, like the young, even the young bucks were just bigger antlered deer than what I was used to seeing hunting out of my camp. So I got pretty obsessed with it and I had so much downtime during COVID that I started my podcast to kind of document my transition from being like a Vermont deer camp hunter to you know, chasing bucks in the suburbs with a bow. And the podcast is Hunt Suburbia Podcast, and basically from the beginning of that is just me on my journey to be a bow hunter. And now I just love bow hunting so much. I still gun hunt. I love gun hunting whenever I can. I still go back to Vermont and hunt my deer camp, but I really love chasing these bucks in the suburbs.
Yeah, so man,
that's
And it's kind of a cool, like, full circle moment for me because I've been listening to the Hunt Suburbia podcast since the very beginning of that thing. Like, I've been listening to it. I want to say since like 2019. Is that right? 2020?
Yeah, I think it was September of 2020 when I started.
Okay, 2020. Yeah. So I mean, I don't know how I found it so early, but I found it early, and like I was definitely a listener, heavy listener, like right from the get go. And now it's really cool to have you on my podcast, and we're sitting here and, you know, shooting the shit. And one thing I wanted to bring up too is we were just talking about shed hunting, and Pat, you were like my introduction really into shed hunting. I don't know if you knew that or not. Yeah.
Not really, but that was such a fun day, man, when you guys came down to... Yeah.
It was because, okay, before I went down to... So what we did was I went down to Pat's and we did a big shed hunt day in the suburbs. And then we did a Hunt Suburbia podcast episode that night. And then I went home or whatever. But before that day, I had only ever found three sheds in my whole life, and they were all like by chance, you know. And like I was,
you weren't like out shed hunting; you were just in the woods, and you had stumbled across one.
Exactly, but I had been looking for sheds a lot like before then, but I just never was successful with it. But I remember when I went down there, and I had found three antlers that day with you, and it was like something clicked. You know, I don't know if it was a confidence thing or if it was, I have no idea. But then that year, I found like 13 antlers, you know, awesome. Like all over the big woods and everything. Like, so it was just such a cool little, you know, introduction. And I mean, you brought me into a pretty gravy spot. So
I brought you into a spot that is, you can't hunt it. It's unhuntable. So, and there's quite a few bucks in there, and it's one of my favorite places to shed hunt, but I really like using that spot to bring people in, that haven't found a lot of sheds. And, Kyle Massey just came down. I don't know if you know Kyle or not from Rutland.
Yeah. I remember him from football too. Like when my brother played.
Yeah. Yeah, tremendous athlete. And he came down, and I took him right into that same spot, and he left with a shed. It was a really small 4-point. You got to see this thing; it fits in the palm of your hand. But it already has webbing and everything. Like, he's a young future booner,
right? That's awesome.
Yeah, but also what's cool about that day when you guys came down?
Yep.
I found a big 6-point side, so a 3-pointer. And then I think you found the other 3-point side, right, of that big one?
Yep. I thought Nate found the other side. Or
maybe Nate found it.
Yeah. So Nate found one side, I found the other. And then the previous year, I think you found both sides, right?
So, no. So that year was the first year I even knew that deer.
And okay.
We matched them up together that day.
Yep.
With our crew. And you know how we were talking before the podcast that I've only found one set of antlers like laying down right next to each other, like how you dream about?
Yes.
That was the following year after you guys came down, and it was that 6-pointer, and he was like even bigger, just a massive 6.
No and kidding.
So we have the matches of him from 2 years ago, from this past year, and I haven't found any of his antlers this year. But he is now like, he's got drop tines, and like he's turned into this crazy deer.
No kidding.
Like, it's really cool to have that history and have you guys be a part of it too.
And Nate. Yeah, that's awesome. Are you going to try to hunt, like try to hunt him somehow on the outskirts of that piece, or is it not really doable?
No, I mean, I'm not really focused on that piece at all. You can't hunt the main piece. There's a few private pieces that abut it that you can get permission. But guys are already in there. I'm sure if I just like put my nose down to the grindstone and like exhausted every option I could, but
right.
I have a few other bucks that I'm after that are in publicly accessible places. You know, a couple other really nice ones. So I'm not even really thinking about that deer. It's just, I like going into there as a little playground and to find sheds.
Right. And like you said, it's such a good introduction to people that want to get into the sport of shed hunting. And because like, man, I don't know about you, but like, I love to shed hunt. I like to do it as much as I like to deer hunt. Like, I really love it.
Oh, me too. And I talk about this with Pat Burns all the time. Like, you almost like it more than deer hunting. And that scares me a little bit. Yeah. You know,
yeah.
Because it's just, I don't know, man, it's so fun. You your guard's down. It's a totally different thing. You're still hunting. But you can like get your hands on like 20 different mature bucks. And when you're hunting, you only get to get your hands on one, and it's so much work in between. But you put a lot of work in between too, with the 65 mile average between your sheds.
Yeah. And I gotta
come back down, and we'll shorten that. We'll shorten that to like 5 miles per shed. Just come back down sometime this month
and get my batting average back up. Yeah. Oh man, dude. Yeah. But I mean, I know since I started shed hunting, there was definitely something that clicked in me. And I feel like I've definitely become a better deer hunter since I've become an avid shed hunter.
Oh yeah.
I don't know if you've noticed that with yourself as well.
Yeah, man, there is so much truth to that.
Yeah.
Like just this year, finding that big match, he's 148 inches or so if he has an 18-inch spread, 8-pointer. Mm. And I think he's got a 20-inch, 21-inch spread. I've seen him on the hoof. I got a picture of him. So I think he's right around 150 this last year. And, you know, finding those sheds showed me, like, it seems weird, but I was pigeonholing him into where I'd seen him before. And 2 years ago, when I found one of his sides, when he was a 3-year-old, you know, I had an idea in my head that he lives down there. There's a sanctuary behind, you know, behind a big farm. And that's where I found the shed, was in that sanctuary. And 2 years ago, and you know, I was like, that he's got to live over there. But this year I wasn't even going after him that day. Per se,
yep.
I was in a place across a major road, you know, on some town, another piece of town land that's not huntable. There's a lot of that around the suburbs of Boston, you know, they're basically just dog walking areas and there's trails through them and they're not huntable. And I just went over there to see what was going on and stumbled across, like I said, it was clearly one of his beds. And there is a possibility this year that I'm going to be able to hunt that, a big piece that abuts that town land. So that's why I was poking around in there. It might be coming online and I might be able to get in there and hunt it. So I was looking around and now I put that piece together. That's one of his bedding areas. And when you just step back and look at it, it's like, wow, this is a perfect big buck bedding area hideout. There's jack pines everywhere. It was logged probably 20 years ago. There's a lot of big mature pines and then little jack pines, which they feel so comfortable in. Mm-hmm. And that's where he was hiding, just in the corner behind some houses in those jack pines. That was his bed. And that day I had my tracking feature and Onyx on, and I covered so much looking for the rest of that, you know, the other side of that shed. And so 4 days later, when I went back in there to try to find it, all I did was pull up Onyx. I saw all the places that I'd covered. Mm-hmm. I double checked a lot of those places because, you know, I went in and out of those jack pines again. You never know when it's around the corner of one of those. And then I was on my way out back to my truck and I was like, oh, look, I can take this route on the way out. And I haven't even been there yet because you can see it clear as day when you're using your tracker. Mm-hmm. There was a whole ridge that I didn't cover. And I just walked that ridge down to the plan was to walk it back to the truck. And I got into a whole bunch of, you know, deer scat and little rolling hills and knobs. And I almost walked past this knob and something in me told me, oh, just, you know, take a right hand turn and go up there and check that real quick. I walked up over the hill, checked it, and there was the match laying there. So now I know two places that he beds, both fairly close to houses. Mm-hmm. But the match was actually on the piece that I might be able to hunt. So if I get to hunt that this year, I learned so much out of just finding that, you know, that match set on how I could potentially hunt that buck.
Yeah, those are like just such vital, you know, pieces of the puzzle that you wouldn't have been able to put together really if you were just going in September and trying to find hot sign and hunt them. You know what I mean? Like, a lot of times those big bucks, I don't think they lay down a ton of sign. Like where you found his antlers, was there a lot of big trees banged up all over the place?
Nope. Yeah. There were actually no rubs in there.
Yeah. I see that so much. And I think that's a trait. And I've had this conversation with somebody else. I can't remember, but I feel like that's a trait that a lot of mature bucks have, but because bucks that make a ton of rubs and a lot of sign like that, I feel like they get killed a lot earlier in life because they're just so much easier to locate.
Yeah.
You know, yeah. So like those ones that get 8, 9, 10 years old, they're just by nature not laying down that sign.
Yeah. Yeah. It's like you know, most criminals in the world are really stupid and they don't do a good job covering their tracks. Yep. And those are the ones that get caught really fast. But every once in a while you get somebody like DB Cooper jumps out of an airplane and makes off with millions. And that's because, you know, he was good at covering his tracks. And that's what I think you're talking about with these big bucks. Mm-hmm. Some of them, something in their DNA or their genetics or something, they're all different, just like us. There's something in a couple of them out there in every patch of woods that are like, you know what? If I make scrapes, if I make rubs, if I'm out here grunting and chasing and all that, those are the dumb ones. Those are the ones that get caught.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. And real quick, do you think DB Cooper is still alive?
No, I don't think he's alive. I don't know. When was that? The 60s? I think he's, I think 70s, he stayed think. Alive.
You think so? You think he made it?
Yeah, I think so. I like to think so.
Dude, can you imagine the balls that guy must have had to jump out of a plane like that in the pitch black?
But I wonder, like, you know, he landed in some wilderness. Like, yeah. I don't know if he ever made it. I don't, like, I think maybe he just you know, had took the money or whatever for the thrill of it, and just, and like he was living in the wilderness where he couldn't spend that money. I don't know if he ever made it out of there, but who knows?
Right.
Who
yeah. knows? And for people who don't know, there's actually like a documentary about it on Netflix. And, it was basically a guy hijacked a plane with a gun, right? In the 60s or 70s. I can't remember. And then he ordered the plane to land, and he wanted a certain amount of money. It was like a ton of money for the time. And then he wanted the plane to take back off. And then when it took back off, he ended up just jumping out of the plane, right? With a parachute.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure. Yeah.
Like that's D.B. Cooper. And nobody, there's like a big like cult following of people that are like trying to figure out who it was and if he lived. And it's kind of an interesting story, but.
Yeah, and so somehow it does relate back into big bucks, though. You gotta find those DB Cooper bucks out there that are not laying down a lot of sign, because I think they're smarter than that.
Yeah, they really are. And I mean, I know with hunting big woods, like all deer are different. That's what I've kind of one of the things that I've learned over the years, and I've found some big old bucks that do love to rub big trees, and those are really fun ones to hunt, but they're just deep, or they're in an area that, like, I find a lot of times nowadays it's like areas with no cell phone reception. Like, you know, you'll find a lot, like a big buck that just loves to rub big trees. Those are fun ones to hunt.
Well, yeah, and especially as a tracker, you know, you get to see when they're making fresh rubs, and
yeah,
That's always probably pretty fun.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, definitely. And, you know, it's just funny, though, because it seems like in the suburbs, those bucks that make those rubs and stuff, like I said earlier, you know, they're just going to die earlier because of the sign they're leaving. But in the big woods, I think they can get away with a little more, maybe.
Yeah. Yeah, there's probably some truth to that. I think, like you said, if I was just going into that patch of woods and trying to hunt it without doing much scouting or any shed hunting, and what I would be doing is going in there and looking for a big scrape,
mm-hmm.
you know, a couple of scrapes, and, you know, not traipsing around too much, but if I walked in on the way and I found out where bedding was and stuff, then I would know that for the next time and to avoid that area and get away downwind of it and, you know, access it the right way. But all I'm looking for in a new patch of woods, if I'm going in to hang and hunt, is a fresh scrape early on, and that's it. And then get up and see what happens. And if there's does around, that's good. But knowing now two of the places he likes to bed, it actually sets up really good for the wind in this area too. And there's a nice saddle that I've got my eye on where I wanna hunt. That saddle is now looking really, really good compared to those bedding areas. So like now I've got a game plan. Now all I got to do is get the permission, and
that's
it's looking
awesome.
Pretty good, but we'll see.
Yep. Yeah. Hopefully you can get right on them. And that saddle would be kind of like a corridor between bedding areas, or like bedding and food, or what are you thinking with that saddle?
That saddle actually is in between. Before I went to the other side of the saddle, I actually found that smaller antler that I was carrying that day.
Yep.
Right in the saddle, right where I was planning on putting a stand. It was right there on a major trail. And on the other side of that trail is a nice thick knob, and there's just 100 piles of scat in there. So I know that was a bedding area. So this saddle actually sets up in between, you know, like three major bedding areas. So I just got to figure out my best way to get in there on my ingress. And, but I've got a perfect spot tree already picked out. There's two major trails on both sides of it going to a pinch point, and I want to get right down in there 35 yards from that pinch point and, in between all three bedding areas, and just wait for that big one to come through.
No kidding. Is there any, creeks or streams that run up near that saddle?
Nope. They're all way down on the bottom of the ridges. So
gotcha.
Yeah, there's no water up on top, but
because that's my favorite way to get into areas. I've always loved to hike up brooks.
Yep.
You know, it seems like I've gotten away with so much hiking up brooks. I think you just literally walk right by deer, and they can't hear you, they can't smell you. Yep. And you know, it's just really good cover.
Oh yeah, no, that's a great piece of info for people to take away.
Yeah.
Especially when you're hunting those really, really big woods and you got to cover a lot of ground, and, you know, just to get to the top of one ridge can take you a while, and, you know, getting over blowdowns and things like that. Those mm-hmm. creeks are, yep, those are awesome.
Yeah, I like to call them the mountain highways.
Yep.
Because yeah. they cut right through the mountain the best way possible. I mean, that's why the water's running down through there.
Yep, they do. You can get yourself into a snaggle of a whole bunch of blowdowns though every once in a while.
That is true. Or slip on rocks.
Yeah.
I have a kind of a funny story. This last season I was muzzleload hunting in New Hampshire, and I went into this area. I'd never been there before, and I went up in, and I ended up missing a really good buck. He got up out of his bed. It was bare ground, and he got up real quick, and I took a crack shot at him and I missed, but he was a really good frame buck. And there was a big river that kind of ran up into this mountain system. And I was like, you know what? Tomorrow I'm going to hike that river all the way up in, try to get above where he was bedding and set up, you know, before daylight. And it was probably like, you know, 2 miles I had to go up this brook. And the next morning I'm going up through in that, I'm hiking my way up through that brook, and I'm sweating because I'm going hard. I'm trying to get up to the top of the mountain before daybreak. And I was almost to the top of that brook, like the top of that mountain. And I remember thinking, I'm like, man, I'm going up through this thing like a ninja. I haven't slipped once. You know, I'm like leapfrogging up through all the rocks. And I no more than thought that. And I fell so hard on a rock. That was a good thing. Oh, no. Good thing my Woodman has a peep sight, because I would have knocked that scope right off. I know I would have.
Oh, man. I was just thinking too. I love when I'm, because I know exactly the state of mind that you were in when you were going up there.
Oh yeah,
you're like, damn, I'm a great woodsman. Look, I'm hopping, I'm hopping from little, you know. Well, I like going through swamps that most people can't cross without getting super wet.
Yeah,
I find those little humps, and you know, you got to like grab onto 45 degree angled trees and. You know, you leap from one to the other and grab onto that and do some, you know, ninja shit, like you said, to get around it. And
yep.
I always end up getting poison oak or something when I do that. But,
yep.
You know, you get to the other side of one of those swamps and you feel super accomplished hopping little mound to mound.
Leapfrogging.
Getting wet.
Yep.
Yep.
Yeah. I always think of like that old video game Frogger. You know, like I'm like bouncing on the little, yeah. Have you ever felt like fallen through ice or water while you were hunting before?
Nope. No, I haven't.
There was this beaver dam, and it was muzzleload season in Vermont. And there was like, you know, the pond was frozen over really good, I thought. And I'm going out across this beaver dam and I'm like, oh, I could, you know, save a bunch of time and kind of cut across the corner of this beaver pond, and I was almost across it on the ice. And when I got to the edge, I right through to my waist. And I was like, way back up in there. Oh yeah.
So what'd you do?
I just start
a fire.
No. So that time I just hiked. I just kept going. I just kept myself warm. I mean, I was wearing wool, so I was okay. But yep. there was this one time, and I don't know if I've probably told this story before, but I was with Nate and we were over in the Adirondacks, and we brought this little flat bottom boat that I had bought for bass fishing. And we had a trolling motor with a car battery in it. And we're like, oh, we're going to go way out across this big lake and like, you know, hunt out in this basin that nobody's getting to or whatever. Which was probably, you know, super illegal. You know, the boat wasn't registered or whatever. And we didn't have life jacket, you know, just really dumb. We were like 20, 21. And we're like halfway across this major lake and this friggin' nor'eastern blew in. And it was like October too. So there was like these big, huge snowflakes coming. And I was wearing blue jeans. I was wearing blue jeans, a t-shirt with an old, like, raggedy woolly. And I remember the wind was blowing and the friggin' the snowflakes were coming and I was soaked. And when we got to the other end of that lake, I was like turning blue. I was so cold. I was shaking. And that was a big lesson right there. I had to take all my clothes off. I got down to my underwear and we had to start a big fire and I had to warm up. But yeah,
dude, that's a nightmare scenario for me. I'm like, I don't know. I'm not afraid of water, but I hate being, I had this thing once, right after college, I was fishing this pond in Vermont and there's some good pike in there. And yep. Me and my buddy Scotland love pike fishing and it wasn't far from UVM.
Yep.
Where we went to college and we were hitting this lake up all the time and fishing it for pike. And, he had a canoe and we went across that lake. There's a nice point on the other side. It's a pond, but it's a big pond. So it's kind of like a lake and, we're beelining it out to this point that all the pike were, hanging out around, all the good ones. And the wind, like you said, picked up like crazy and just on a pond. Yep. And like we almost capsized so many times. It wasn't like freezing cold or anything, but just being out there in a canoe, which is very, unstable. If one person like freaks out, you guys could tip over. And I just hated that experience so much that, I think about that all the time. So I'm not, I wouldn't be for that Adirondack paddling.
Oh yeah. I mean, that was really stupid on our part, but that was like totally like just throw caution to the wind type thing. We were young and dumb and just full of it. Yep. And we were just gonna, we didn't really think about it too much. We're just like, oh yeah, we'll just take my flat bottom 8-foot plastic boat with a trolling motor across this thing and we'll be fine. But yeah, wearing lacrosse boots at that. So if we went over, we'd be, that would be terrible because you're wearing friggin' like 10-pound basically cinder blocks to your feet. Like,
yeah.
Oh yeah, did some dumb stuff, but hey, yeah. Still here. So,
yeah, Jim Massett told me a great story, and he's in his 80s, and he might have been late 70s in this story, or he could have been in his 80s too, but he shot a buck and he called his wife to let him know, and up in the Adirondacks, and he was like, I'm thinking about putting it in this. In this boat, I can't remember if it was a canoe or what it was, and going and paddling it across the lake. And she said, whatever you do, don't do that. Cause there was a nor'easter coming in.
Yep.
And she was like, stay off of that lake. But he did it anyway. He's like, I tried to hang close to shore, but he was like battling for his life out there. It was the one time that he needed help to get out of the woods and people around couldn't believe it. They're like, nah, like even the rescue crews and stuff, right? They're like, nah, Jim Massett doesn't need help,
but right.
He had to get helped out of there. But yeah, it was a great story on my podcast interview with him.
Yeah. And I wanted to kind of highlight, you do a living legend series with your podcast and it is phenomenal.
I appreciate that, dude.
Yeah, man. Like my favorite episodes you've done, the 2-part series with Lanny Benoit.
Yep.
Oh,
that was the first one. That was the first Living Legend series. I was like, dude, I can get a podcast with Lanny. That was before he had done a podcast. So I was just like, this can't be just a regular podcast. I got to come up with something.
Yeah. And then,
yeah. Yep.
Awesome. Awesome stuff. Like the stories he told and stuff. And then you've gotten a bunch of other guys since then. And are you kind of doing more of like the living legend stuff? Like, is that kind of what you're doing with the podcast now? Or are you doing a lot of the like regular episodes too?
Well, it's a couple of things. Like when I first started out the first couple of years, I did a podcast every week.
Mm-hmm.
And that was super important, to gain a following and an audience. And I had a lot of fun doing that. And a lot of great hunters too that are legends in their own right, you know, as well. But I just couldn't keep that schedule up with, you know, kids started popping out, hunt stock started taking off a little bit. And I didn't have the time to be able to keep up with that weekly schedule anymore. So yeah, I am trying to do, you know, more, you know, being more selective with my guests and getting those, the living legends on, but I'm still doing podcasts whenever I have some free time, you know, scheduling podcasts with anybody. So we've got a couple coming out, in the next few weeks, that are just, you know, kind of regular, normal guests. But yeah, I'm trying to do more of those Living Legend series, big guests, as I can, as I got to be kind of conscious of my time right now.
Right. And that's a perfect segue into what I kind of wanted to talk about a little bit with what is, you and Pat Burns are the creators of Hunt Stock, correct?
Yep.
Which is, it's a hunting show, but it's unlike any other hunting show that I've ever been to. And, you've had it for 2 years now. And both years, both years were phenomenal. And I just wanted to touch on that a little bit. I wanted to know, where did the idea come from? You know, number one. And then number two, like, how did you like bring it all together? Because for my brain, it's kind of hard to visualize how you made it happen.
Well, it was kind of like my whole career after college was with Spartan Race, which is an event company. It's a obstacle course racing company, competitive obstacle course racing. And I took a lot from my experience there. I wore a lot of hats at Spartan Race. I, you know, started their merchandise program and the apparel program right out of college. No experience, just thrown into the fire, having to learn stuff and take on roles, which was awesome. Because my previous job before that, you know, I was just doing cold calls for telemarketing companies, selling phone numbers. Like I was renting phone numbers out, like 1-800 new Ford phone numbers that like spelled stuff out. Such an antiquated like marketing thing.
Oh my gosh.
I did that for 2 years, selling phone numbers that spelled stuff.
Wow.
Like calling a company is like, hey, you're a Ford dealer. I've got the phone number 1-800 new Ford. you should rent this number in the Boston area. And they'd be like, what? Like just the Boston area? We're like, yeah, we got Ford dealers out in New York. How it works is like, if somebody calls with a New York area code, we route that to the New York dealer. Mm-hmm. If they call from, and it was just a bullshit job. So yeah. going from that to, a startup company, because Spartan Race was a startup. Mm-hmm. When I was there, and they'd only done two events by the time that I joined, and then being given all this responsibility, it really allowed me to learn trial by fire. I learned so much. I had to learn what sponsorships were. I had to learn how to deliver value to brands that wanted to come to the races and talk to the people that were racing it, our consumers, our attendees at the event. So it forced me to learn what brands needed, how to make those important connections between brands and the consumers. Mm-hmm. Forced me how to, you know, learn how to value properties and value, you know, how much value can a brand get out of a race, and what does that mean for their bottom lines and this and that. So I learned a ton there. As I was there for 12 years, the director of, you know, global partnerships and sponsorships there, did over $25 million in deals with brands. And the whole time, you know, I'm thinking, this is great. Getting a lot of experience. I have a lot of knowledge here now, but I'm just not passionate about obstacle course racing. Like I didn't connect with the racers, the consumers. That wasn't me. I don't, in my spare time, I don't like to, you know, do CrossFit and run. I like to go out and deer hunt. So I was thinking for a long time, for probably 5 years before Hunt Stock started, how could I do something in the hunting space? You know, something that I actually love and take the knowledge of running an event company to do that. And then through the podcast, I just heard from a bunch of people, you know, how, and they knew my background at Spartan Race, and they're like, dude, why don't you just start an event, you know, an event or a hunting show? So that's kind of where it all started. I had been thinking about it for a while, and then I started getting people saying like, hey, you should do that. And to be honest, where it was really going to start was, I liked what Total Archery Challenge was doing. They, mm-hmm. they had a fresh idea, something that was exciting, attracting a young demographic. And they built really badass courses, and it aligned a lot with how Spartan was built and run too, where we, you know, Spartan Race, we'd have 25 obstacles that were built. Mm-hmm. And each one has like elaborate plans and has a whole build crew that has to put that obstacle together safely and, you know, up and down ski mountains and stuff. And that's the same thing that Total Archery Challenge was doing, except it was easier. You're just setting up a target instead of building something massive. You know, you're setting up targets throughout the same type of resorts and venues that Spartan Race was at. So I was thinking originally to start a company that would be a competitor to Total Archery Challenge and just do 3D archery. Mm-hmm. And then I went to a Total Archery Challenge and just experienced it as an attendee. I didn't even, you know, shoot the course. And it's undoubtedly the best 3D archery event that there is in the country. And it's really apparent. And they had a bunch of great brands there, but there was no real like hub, no feeling in the festival area, like this super exciting festival experience. It was 95% of the time people were out shooting, and 5% of their time at the event, they were in that festival. So mm-hmm. it seemed like to me, and I'd only been to the Vermont one. I know there's a ton of them across the country, and maybe they do have that. And I'm sure they do in some of the other events, but at that Vermont one, that's what I experienced. And that's where it clicked to me. I was like, why don't I do something similar to this, but flip it. So 95% of the hub and the energy is in the festival. And I still want to have a 3D course, but we'll keep it to 20 targets. You know, you kind of shorten it so that people aren't out there all day long. They can go out and shoot real quick, get their rocks off doing that, and then come back to that central hub, which is, you know, the festival area at Huntstock and all the stuff that we've got going on there. So that's basically where it started. And just threw that first one together, found a great farm. They were listeners of the podcast. They heard me talking about floating the idea, and they reached out and said, hey, come check out our farm. So I went that very same weekend and went and checked it out, and I could envision it happening there. And, you know, then we're off and running, and you guys came to that first one, and it was just a really, really cool experience to see it all come together. And, I feel like we're on to something now.
Definitely. It sounds like it was a real perfect storm for, you know, cooking up what is now Huntstock, you know, and, it's really easy to see for, you know, me and I think everybody else. It's something that you're like, you're super passionate about it. You know, it seems more of like, it's like your passion doing this thing, not a business, you know? And I think that kind of, that bleeds through with the experience. I know Rodney Elmer said, he said it's like a giant deer camp, and I couldn't agree more. Yep. It really is. And like, you know, I've been to a bunch of shows, and I'll tell you straight up, Huntstock takes a cake. You know, it's really fun. Now, do you want to tell me, where'd you come up with the name Huntstock?
Pat Burns actually came up with the name. We were on the phone. I was down in Texas, visiting family, and we had already, you know, we're like, all right, let's start the company. Now we need a good name. And I can't remember what some of the original name ideas were that we were floating out. But I said to him, I was like, you know, I want it to feel like a coming together, like it's a movement, mm-hmm. like the Woodstock 69. It was like the thing that everybody talks about in music festivals, the godfather of them, it's the Woodstock. Mm-hmm. He's like, he just went Huntstock. And I'm like, dude, yeah, that's it. That's it. Let's do it.
That's really cool.
Yeah, Pat's a great creative mind. We both have creative creative minds, and he's a great person to bounce ideas off of, and he always comes up with some really great stuff. And yeah, he came up with the name.
Yeah, that's cool. I want to get Pat. I want to get him on the Big Buck Theory as well. So maybe maybe you could reach out to him and tell him that I want to have him on, and I'll get a hold of him or whatever. But he's quite the deer hunter himself.
Yeah, he is. He's got determination. That story with the electric buck was like the craziest, you know, determination story of hunting the same deer that I'd ever heard. And that's how we met. I had him on my podcast. I met him, just wanted to talk to him about, he hadn't even killed the electric buck at that point, but he'd killed some slammers, and he was just known for finding giant sheds. Mm-hmm. So I had him on, and, to talk about all that. He came in with, an armful of just slammer sheds. And it was just from like that year. And a lot of them, well, he had the electric buck sheds, and then he had stuff that he had found that year, and he was holding on to them like they were, like they were books from college. He just looked like a college. He had glasses on, looked like a little college kid coming in holding his textbooks, but they were, all of his giant sheds. But yeah, we had that podcast, and then we just started talking after the podcast about life. And he, you know, come to find out, he used to be a rapper, and he was signed to a really big rap deal, like $1 million deal, like under P. Diddy's label, like a subset of that, in the early 2000s. Like, he was a really good rapper.
Wow.
And I was a rapper back in the end of high school and into college too, but nowhere near as good as Pat. But we're both, you know, both named Pat, both, you know, white guys that are failed rappers that are now big into deer hunting. So we bonded pretty quickly.
Yeah, that is cool. You guys are unique for that, for sure. Being rappers and deer hunters, you know, you don't see that a whole lot.
Yeah. Yep. And we actually represent, you know, some big rappers too on the sponsorship side. Like, we're kind of agents. Mm-hmm. We haven't brought any deals. We're working on big deals for a couple of major artists, and hopefully we're really close to actually landing our first deal there too. So yeah, we've got our toes into both hunting and the music industry a little bit, and doing a little bit of, you know, everything here and there to keep ourselves busy.
No kidding. Yeah, I know you. You were in the music video for Joyner Lucas's, one of his rap videos, right?
Yeah. Yep, we're both Secret Service agents guarding Joyner Lucas and his recent video.
No kidding. I know. He's
been in a bunch of them.
He has, yeah, yeah. I know. He recently put out a song. It's on the old Mac Miller track.
Oh, there. Yeah. That's a great song.
Oh, it's a good song, man.
Yeah, that one is, what is that one
I think
called?
It's 17, right?
Yeah, 17.
Yeah, yep. That is a good song for sure.
Yeah, and the one that Pat and I are in is 24 Hours to Live, posted 4 months ago. I was on the way out into the woods. I had all my camo on, just got in my truck, and I was about to go bow hunting, and Pat called me, and he's like, hey, you want to be in a music video? And I was like, yeah, sure, let's do it.
Yeah.
So I he's like, dude, you got to, like, get cleaned up, and I had to, like, it happened so fast. Just had to go in, change, shave, pick my head, and showed up. And it was a lot of fun. It was a cool experience. I don't think I was going to kill a big buck that day anyway. So
right. Yeah. Fun. You can't really turn that down anyway. It's not every day you get asked to be in a music video. So
no, nope.
No.
So that was fun.
Yeah. Well, that's all good stuff. And switching gears a little bit, you killed a really nice buck last year.
Yep. I got a nice one.
You want to talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, sure. So there's, like, a little bit of a story before that. It was the first year since I've been doing my podcast and transitioning into a bow hunter,
yep,
that I didn't release an arrow on a deer. I hunted a lot. I hunted more than I have, I think, in any other year in terms of number of sits, mm-hmm, because I've got kids now. I can't sit the morning and evenings. I'm choosing one, and I still have to bring my son to daycare and pick him up. So I was doing a lot of mid-morning sits, you know, getting in at 8:30 and then sitting until dark, when it was, you know, before 5, and then as the time rolls back, you know, I wouldn't even get that last hour either. But I was doing lots of sits, lots of all-day sits, and a lot of midday sits, and I saw tons of deer. I passed a bunch of bucks. I think I passed 15 or so 8-pointers within range, and they just weren't the ones. I had some really good ones on camera I was holding out for. But I passed probably 120 incher a couple of times. I passed one that might have been in the 130s, but he had so much potential that I wanted him to live another year. He had a split brow, and both of the splits were like 8 inches. Wow. He had like the other brow tine was like a 10 inch brow. He was really nice. And, I just thought he could have been a mega giant next year. So I passed him. I saw him quite a bit out of range too this year. I saw him probably 5 different encounters with him. And he ended up getting shot. A lot of the deer that I had my eye on, just I couldn't make it work. I'm hunting small pieces, and I need them to get, and that's just the game in the suburbs. You got to find the small legal piece. Mm-hmm. You know, people with lesser morals would, you know, go into the places you can't hunt and drag those deer out. But I do it by the book, and I'm, you know, on these little postage stamps and stuff, and I need them to get in real close, and I just never had the opportunity. So I didn't release an arrow at all this year, which I was kind of excited about going into gun season. I'm like, all right, well, now I'll take the gun out. And after you've been a bow hunter for so long and going back to holding a gun in your hand, it feels like a cheat code. You're like, hold, you know, you're like, I can poke out 100 yards now, no problem. Like, This is awesome.
Yeah.
So opening day gun season comes around, and I don't have in Massachusetts, you can only use shotguns, or muzzleloader, or no rifles. I don't even own a deer hunting shotgun. So if I get to gun season, I take out my Woodman Arms and, had that with me on opening day of gun season. I went to a big patch of public land that I like to hunt. And I figured, well, I haven't been in here this year. Let's go for gun season and check it out. And it was one of those quiet, you know, pretty rainy. It was rainy in the morning. The leaves were soft, and it was windy. So my plan was to get in there, sit down in the morning for the first hour, up on a ridge, looking over some funnels, and then get up and move around. And I got in, and you know, I don't hunt these type of wood. I'm pretty much tagged out most of the time going into gun season. So I'm just not used to what ended up happening. I saw so many people in there, man. It was crazy. Sitting on the top of this ridge, as soon as the sun's up, there's people going right down below me through the funnel, calling every 5 seconds. So I got up and I was like, all right, well, I see where they're going. I'm going to swing around the ridge and kind of try to parallel them in case they push something up to me. But I wanted to get to this particular patch where I'd seen some really good bucks a few years before that, in bow season. So I started making my way that way, shadowing those guys in case they bump something up, checked the camera on the way. And I just did a real big swing, probably 2.5-mile, 3-mile swing, and got to the other side of this big public piece. And I was pretty winded. And I was walking up a steep hill, and there's a major dirt road. You can't drive trucks on it, but there's a major dirt road that goes through the middle of this public, closed to vehicles. And I was like, even though it felt like cheating for me for some reason, I was like, yeah, I'll just walk the dirt road to the top of the hill. So I got on there. I was, you know, sucking pond water a little bit, and trudging up that hill and just going real slow. And all of a sudden I see a big body of a deer, on the ridge top off the right side of this road. There's a big body. I can't see the head, just see a big body sticking out from beside a tree. It ended up being a doe. She was about, you know, 20 yards down the ridge. So not on the crest, but 20 yards down. And I see that big body, and, I just freeze. And I was in like this half step motion. My left leg was forward and kind of bent, and my back leg was straight. And I just didn't want to move because she was locked onto me. I lifted up my gun slowly to see what it was and saw that it was a doe, and she was frozen. And I was leaning off to the left, you know, to check if she had antlers. Mm-hmm. And when I saw saw her face, she was just looking right down my scope. So I was afraid to move. I didn't want to move because I was thinking, you know, there's could be a buck with her. So I'm looking behind her and trying to see if I can make anything out, any movement. And eventually I saw a little bit of movement, but I thought it was like a squirrel's tail or something. It wasn't a big movement. It was just a little bit of movement on the crest of that ridge. Mm-hmm. And I lifted up my Woodman slowly, and I could see four tines on each side moving around. So I knew it was at least a 10 pointer. Mm-hmm. And it was just, you know, it was the buck was on the other side of the ridge, and all I could see were like the tips, the top couple inches of some tines moving through some thick stuff. So I was like, all right, cool, I'm in the game now. And now I just got to wait, and I hope that doe lets her guard down and she just keeps walking. She was traversing that ridge. Hopefully she keeps going. She would have crossed that road, you know, right in front of me, and I would have had a great shot. So that was my thought. Ended up being in a standoff with her for 8 to 10 minutes, and she finally blew at me like 8 minutes in.
No kidding.
When she blew at me, I'm like, all right, something's going to happen here. She could go back over the other side of that ridge. She could run across the road, but if that buck is going to follow her. So I got to be ready. And I'm waiting to see what happens. She blew at me the one time, and then 30 seconds later, she blows again. And when she blows again, I see the buck crest the ridge. He comes up like majestically, like cresting the ridge. And I have my scope right up there on him. And I got the crosshairs on his throat patch, and he was wide. He was 2 feet wide. The antlers, all the tines curved outward. Like they all, it was just, he looked like a red stag cresting that hill. And then she blew again. And when she blew, he turned his head and looked at her. So I had the profile of his neck now. And I was like, all right, there's no way. I got to shoot now. I dropped the crosshairs right to the middle of his neck and shot. And, smoke everywhere, and I didn't know what the hell happened. I couldn't see him. I was like, maybe he went over the other side, maybe he fell down right there on the other side of the ridge, because he was right on the crest. And I'm just not reloading, you know, being an idiot. I should have immediately been reloading fast, but I was just watching to see what, you know, waiting for movement or seeing something. Mm-hmm. I eventually see that his white belly, he fell on my side of the ridge, and he was there. He was there, looked like he was dead. Then, you know, I start filming myself like a dumbass, like, oh, I just shot a big buck and da 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 da. And he starts kicking and like doing a spin up mm-hmm. there. And I'm like, oh shit, I got to reload. So I start going for reload. I fumble the reload really badly. I just messed up the reload. It's all on me messing up that reload. He stopped. I thought he died like 5 times, dude. He would stop, and I'm like, oh, he's dead. Cool. So I don't need to keep reloading. Like, I don't know what was going on in my head, but I just messed up. And he ended up pushing himself across that ridge with his back legs. It looked like his front legs were paralyzed. And he was just kicking, using his back legs, pushing himself across that ridge slowly. Like, I had given me perfect broadside shots. If I would have had a shotgun on me, I would have had follow-up shots. If I would have had my reload down, he would have been dead. Long story short, I just didn't get reloaded in time. He got up and he slowly walked over the ridge. And by the time I finally put my primer in, all I could see were the tips of his tines again descending over the other side. So I was just like a few seconds too late. Never ended up finding him. He had a blood trail. I looked around, couldn't find him. Found out there was a hunter that knew that buck and had seen him for years. And he was like a 10-year-old buck. And he, according to this guy, he said that no one's ever had a shot on him before. He couldn't believe that he even gave me a shot, because he's just super smart. Never saw him. But that guy ended up telling me in mid-December that he's like, hey, that buck was alive the very next day. I had him on camera, like nothing happened, and you could see the hole in his neck. Mm. And so he was alive, but the guy didn't want to tell me. The guy was acting like, you know, he's like, he was sick to his stomach. He felt like he lost a friend, he said.
Oh, my gosh. You know,
like, I couldn't get out of bed. You know, I lost one of my good friends. You know, that deer meant a lot to me. And he's like, I'll let you know if he comes back. So just to, you know, just to let you know. And didn't, because he knew that I'd be in there trying to hunt him again. So that was 2 days before I ended up killing this good one. the next day after I shot that buck, I went in to look for him again and grid searched everywhere and couldn't find him. So I spent that day just grid searching. And then I had this hunt the next day. That's a lottery hunt in a place you normally can't hunt in Massachusetts. They actually opened it up. It's the Quabbin hunt. Mm-hmm. It's pretty cool. It's pretty fun. They open it up to everybody. So they hunt it every year now. And, I went in there and, just kind of like a hang and bang. There's 2 days that you're allowed to scout it, but I couldn't make those scouting days. So I went in there blind. First day there were just guys walking around everywhere, kind of like similar to that first day gun season. 2 days earlier, I was just trying to get away from people that mm-hmm. whole first day. I saw some deer, but I just didn't have a lot of fun. I saw people everywhere. So the second day of the hunt's only a 2 day hunt. I was like, all right, I'm bringing a stand in here. It seemed like everybody had stands and I was just hunting from the ground, you know, the Vermont roots. But yep. The second day I went in there with a stand and I was like, I'm going to get as far away as I can. I'm going to find a funnel that nobody else wants to get to because it's hard. I scouted that and on X found one, used the leaf off imagery feature, which is sick. I don't know if you've used that before, but
I
could see where,
what's the feature?
Leaf off imagery.
Oh yeah, dude. That's all. I keep my Onyx on that all the time.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. That was integral to this year. Cause, all the intel I gathered from the day before is you want to be on the edge of like the jack pines and the pines in that forest. So mm-hmm. I found a nice edge and a perfect funnel. And I was so stoked to get in there. I'm like, I'm going to get in there early mm-hmm. and I'm sitting all day. I don't care if I see people, if they go by my stand, I'm just sitting. I'm not moving around. So I was pumped for that. And I went in, again, using my muzzleloader and, I get in there about a half hour before shooting light. I get all set up. I climb up in my stand. It was a tough walk. I'm sweating and I got my camera set up and everything ready to film. And I go to put my primer in my muzzleloader. And I lost my tube of primers that I had in like the shotgun shell thing and on my orange vest that you got to wear.
Yep.
And it's not there, dude. And it, like my heart sunk. I'm like, dude, I got no primers. I lost that tube somewhere on the way in. Mm-hmm. I'm not even going to be able to hunt. So now I get into panic mode and I'm feeling real down and I just get climb down the tree as fast as I can. And I basically run back to the truck. Like I'm doing my obstacle course racing shit back to the truck.
Yeah, yep.
Because I want to get there as fast as I can just to see if I have any extra primers. And I knew I would not be able to, if I had lost the tube between the truck and the stand location somewhere in the woods, it's a lost cause. I'm not finding that in the dark. Mm-hmm. Wouldn't even find it in the daylight. So I went to the truck, looked around the edges of the truck, the doors that I opened, and I still didn't see it. I turned over some leaves with my boot and there was the tube primers outside of the door. So I was like, ooh. I felt now I feel elated. I'm just like, now I feel like mm-hmm. in ecstasy. I found it. I can get back in there and hunt. So I booked it back through the woods, making all kinds of noise, just running fast as I can to get back to my stand. And I actually got in there like 1 minute after legal light. So I was there, you know, pretty much the whole day. Mm. So now I'm feeling good and I'm excited for the day. I actually get to hunt. I don't see anything in the morning. Never saw a hunter, which was sweet. I end up seeing a bear around 11 a.m. And then at 1 o'clock, I hear my first, you know, blatant deer trotting, you know, coming out of the jack pine. So, mm-hmm. Turn on my camera. I see two does running through the jack pines, and 2 seconds behind them, a big buck busts out. And I'm like, oh boy, here we go. Mm. So they're going through the jack pines. I got great footage of this, and the does bust out this other row of jack pines out into the open, right in perfect shooting lanes. They come out there. He's grunting the whole time. His big old rack comes out of the jack pines and they trot right below my stand about 40 yards, the doe, and that buck is right on him. He makes a brief, you know, he kind of stops and pauses out of that trot, and I put one right into his shoulder, and it was a good shot, and I thought he was dead immediately there, but I learned from the day before, you know, the 2 days before, it's like reload as fast as you can and just keep your eye on that buck. Just don't even think about anything else. Mm. So I did I didn't move my camera. I turned around and sat on the rail of my climber, which I was using, facing the tree. I watched that buck. He went up this little ridge and he bedded down. And I'm reloading, keeping my eye on him. He's struggling. He's making a lot of, you know, death sounds and stuff. He's struggling in his bed. I get a quick reload, hands up, standing up out of his bed, struggling to his feet. And I shot him again and he dropped, and that's where he laid, you know, and he was dead. And it was just an incredible hunt. I had no idea how big he was. He was the biggest deer I think I've seen while hunting, was the impression I got out of him. Just how, you know, how big and bossy he was. He had real, he has five and a half inch bases. He had so much mass on his antlers. Ended up having kind of short times, but I don't care. I mean, he might not even score as my biggest deer, but to me, he's the biggest buck I ever shot. And I was just super happy about it, man. And after going through that shitty experience 2 days earlier,
right?
And then being so low, thinking I wasn't even be able to hunt, I lost my primers. And then, you know, that's just the ups and downs of hunting, man. And I was blessed to take them.
Yeah, no, that's a wicked story. And, you know, it was getting late in the year and you just kept persevering and you got paid off for it, you know?
Yep.
That's what happens. That's what happens when you don't quit.
And then dude, you wouldn't believe this. So I get back home and I'd go through the footage and, I'm watching the footage, you know, him busting out of the jack pines to get the shot on film. It's, you know, everything was framed up nice and the camera was still rolling. And when I turned around and sat on the rail and reloaded and kept my eye on that buck, that camera rolled for 3.5 minutes until it was all over and I stopped the record. I didn't know in real time, but when I watched the footage, it was still in that same spot where they busted out of the jack pines, right?
Mm-hmm.
And lo and behold, like 45 seconds after I shot, there was another big buck, a satellite buck, that just walked by my stand at 45 yards, broadside, taking a stroll, big 10 pointer. And I didn't even see him in real time because I was so locked on just making sure I finished the deal on that first buck. But I did have an extra tag and I could have shot him. It's just funny how that all works out, but it makes for great footage too.
That's awesome. Now, when are you going to release that footage?
I don't know. And whenever I can find some time to work on it here and there, I have so much footage throughout the season. I just got to think about how I want to put together, you know, a film that tells the story in the best way. So I'll probably end up releasing it closer to deer season this year, if I had to guess.
Yeah, I think that's smart. I think that's when they do the best.
Yeah. And by the way, we didn't talk about, there's a film festival at Huntstock this year, and I hope you enter something into that. And you know, I would enter. I can't enter my own film festival. But yeah. I'm still thinking about editing it the way that you know to try to be a film festival quality type film. I obviously won't enter it into that, but
right.
That's how I'm thinking about it.
Yeah, do you want to talk a little bit about that, like how you enter it and all that stuff?
Yeah, actually, we haven't made any like real live announcements, but it's all pretty much put together. So. Just like Huntstock is, you know, it's a celebration of the Northeast and Northeast hunting and our Northeast culture. So, the prerequisite is it has to be about Northeastern hunting. You can't enter any films from outside the Northeast, and there's no elk and no, you know, any of that. It's gotta be a Northeastern style hunt. It can be for anything that we hunt in the Northeast, but it's gotta be about the Northeast. There's no time limit, you know, recommend to keep it under 30 minutes, but no time limits on it. Anybody who wants to enter, you enter your full length film and then you also submit an under 2 minutes kind of trailer or short version of it, which is a great editing exercise for people, to do anyway, because most people's films there's too much fluff in there. So you got to submit the full length and then a short length. And at Huntstock, the Thursday night before Huntstock is the film festival. We're going to show the top 10 films. And we've got a board of 5 judges. Right now, Tom Miranda, legendary bow hunter, he's one of the judges. Chris Ford, who is a big time hunter, and he owns an advertising agency, puts together all kinds of content in Boston with a lot of clients. He's actually doing a lot of work on the Revelist in the hunting world right now too. He'll be another judge. John Lewis from Just Hunt Club is the third judge. Chris Borgatti from Backcountry Hunters and Anglers is the fourth judge. And we are working on the fifth and final judge, but they're going to look at the films and basically judge on, let me actually pull up, see if I can find the graphics that we're going to release here and go through. But basically it's, they're going to judge on storytelling is the biggest portion of it. It's like 50% of the entire weight is how well are you doing at telling the story.
Yep.
Keeping people interested, not getting, you know, you don't want to lose anybody's interest. Did you stay on the edge of your seat the whole time? If you did, then you're going to get, you know, close to a 50 on that. So there's 50 points for storytelling. I believe it's 20 points for like wildlife footage. Don't quote me on any of that. I'm going to make a post, but just look at Huntstock Fest on Instagram. And you can go to the website, huntstockevents.com, and it's all going to be there within the next week when we make the announcement. But another big thing is we wanted to, we did the board and the judging because some of the other film festivals that we've been to, it's like the people in the audience get to vote. Mm-hmm. And it's like a text to win type thing. And, you know, we saw that brands were amplifying that once it came on. The intention was good that people in the audience voted, mm-hmm. but then it becomes a popularity contest. And then if like there's a major brand there, you know, a Kuyu or a Vortex or somebody that might have like sponsored somebody in it, you know, maybe they were putting it on their social and telling people that weren't even there to text. And it felt like it was manipulated. It was able to be manipulated. So we wanted to have a film festival that's actually just judged on the merits by quality judges.
Right.
And so, you know what I mean? So that's,
yeah,
that's what we're going with. And we've got a $5,000 prize pool, mm-hmm. which is bigger than even the most prestigious film festivals. You know, first place is $3,000 and second place is second place is $1,500 and third place is $500. So all about the Northeast high prize pool. It's going to be a really fun, cool event. So if you guys can make it, if you buy a VIP pass to Huntstock, you get that for free. If you just want to show up on Thursday night, you don't have a VIP pass, it's $20 to get in. It's going to be a pretty epic night with some awesome films.
That's awesome. Yeah, I'm looking forward to that. And I am planning on entering. When's the due date for the videos?
June 1st. So you got to enter by June 1st, and you got to enter by, you can either send a Dropbox link or an unlisted YouTube link, like load it up to your YouTube page, unlist it so nobody can see it except for whoever has that link. You drop that link in an email, email it to Pat Burns. He's running it. Sevone, SEVONE@me.com. And you can CC huntsuburbia@gmail.com. And we're going to take all the links that we get, all the submissions, put them into a spreadsheet and share that spreadsheet with the judges. And then they're going to all submit scorecards. Again, you'll be able to see how the scoring's all broken down, officially on the website, but then we'll just basically sort it all out from top 10 and reveal the top 10 films at the film festival. 10 through fourth place, we're going to show the short version because we can't be in there for 6 hours watching everybody's full length film. So
right.
10th place through fourth place, we'll show the short versions. And then we'll take an intermission, do some door prizes, and then we'll show the top three films in full, the full lengths of them back to back. So it's all going to be kind of revealed right there. So,
right. And are you guys dead set on the June 1st thing?
Yeah.
Okay.
Because we got to give, we don't know how many submissions we're going to get yet. And we want to make sure that the judges have ample time to, you know, watch, and we don't want them to feel like they're rushed, you know, going through reviewing 20 films.
Yep.
So we want to give them ample time. So yeah, if everybody can get their stuff edited up by June 1st, yep. That's the deadline this year, and we'll see how that goes. That'll give the judges have to submit by August, first week of August, so that rolling into Huntstock, we got everything set. So that'll give them, you know, 8 weeks to watch all the films.
Cool. Yeah, that yep. It's definitely one of a kind. So it's going to be the I mean, do they do like national scale like hunting film fests?
Yeah. Oh yeah.
They do.
Like
yeah.
Badlands.
Okay. Yep, I've heard of that
Badlands
one.
Badlands at ATA every year. That's a national film festival.
Gotcha.
Yeah, so there's a couple of them, but we wanted to make something unique for the Northeastern guys.
Yeah, that's cool. I think that's really great because, you know, the Northeast is just very unique with the kind of stuff that we're filming.
Yeah, it's hard. Like, the hunting's harder, and then the filming is, like, twice as hard because right. The hunting is already hard, you know? And if you bring somebody that films you, that makes it hard. Everything I'm doing is self-filmed, and mm-hmm. that's another thing. That's another thing, too, is we didn't want to – there's a cinematography category that you're going to get judged on.
Mm-hmm.
But it's basically on the framing of your shots and the shot selection, not on the quality of the camera. So if you're just using a cell phone, you have just as good a chance as if you're using a $10,000 camera.
Right.
That's the way the criteria for the judges is laid out, that they can't deduct points if it's, you know, lower resolution, because we want everything to be accessible, and not, you know, have it be just for people who can afford good cameras or afford to hire an editor. We want people that can do it all on their own to be entering films.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's cool. Yeah. Very cool.
So,
all right, man. Well, this has been a really great conversation. I've enjoyed it a lot.
Yeah, me too, dude. We got to get you down here to do some shed hunting. We'll go back in that same patch and try to find the... The drop time six.
Yeah, man, for sure. I definitely want to make it down there. I just had Tyler Forbes on. His episode is going to be coming out this Friday. So
nice.
Yeah, I was just talking.
I love Tyler.
Yeah, yep. Yeah. I was just talking to him about getting down there at some point, and you know that whole the suburban bow hunting thing really just intrigues me, just because it's like it's really built for bow hunting. You know, and I do want to get down there and do some in the future.
Well, yeah, because you want to save your Vermont tag for tracking,
yep,
right?
Yep. That's,
and Vermont bow hunting is really hard anyway, but not that, you know, being hard stops you. But
right.
You 100% have access to Massachusetts, dude. And you have two tags in Mass. Even if you come down to just bow hunt, you get one of them, you still got a tag for late season to go tracking down here too. So yeah, like you should, I know time is the issue sometimes, but if you can right. find it, you know, I'm happy to go out and do some hunting with you and bring you into, you know, some of my spots if you want to. And, yeah, that'd be great. We could do content together on it. And even, we talked about going into the Hockomock Swamp
yeah.
before.
That, yeah. We got to go fight off the Pudgewuggies. What are they called?
Puckwudgies.
The Puckwudgies. Yeah. And they're the Indian spirits that haunt the Hockomock. Is that right?
Yeah, they look like little raccoons. They got spikes coming out of their back. They're a foot and a half tall. And no, but in all seriousness, though, yeah. I've never been to the Hockomock Swamp. I know there's big deer in there. It's a huge swamp. It's like 20,000 acres or something. It's the biggest swamp in Massachusetts. It's got tons of Native American history, you know, mm-hmm. back in the French and Indian War, you know, the natives, if they were ever had an assault that they couldn't defend, they would just retreat into the middle of the swamp because the Europeans didn't know the swamps and they were afraid of them, but the Indians lived in there and they, you know, would go deep into the Hockomock and retreat in there and they'd be safe. And, yeah, there's all kinds of lore around that swamp. There's, you know, Bigfoot sightings, there's UFO sightings. It's known as the Bridgewater Triangle. There's some documentaries about that. Just all kinds of supernatural stuff that people say that they've seen in there. Puckwudgies are one of them. Big black wolves are another one that people have reported seeing in there. You know, wolves that end up walking on two legs and shit. Like, you know, I don't say that I believe in all of this stuff, but right. I keep an open mind. It's more fun to go through life that way. So
right.
there's an allure to the Hockomock, and if we ended up going down and hunting that, we would have to do an overnight, I think.
That'd dude, yeah, and that would make such a cool storyline too.
Really, it really was.
You know, it'd be like a really sweet YouTube video, and you know, all those monsters and stuff that are in there, and monster bucks.
Actually, dude, that is a great idea for somebody that wants to enter Huntstock Film Festival in 2025.
Yeah,
is like that would be a really cool new take on a hunting video. Is hunting and supernatural.
Hey,
you know, ghost hunting and deer hunting.
Don't give too many people too many ideas. That might be my entry for 25, man. Come on.
No, yeah, seriously.
Yeah. Well, I look forward to collabing with you and coming down there, and you'll have to come up to the Big Woods too, man. Me and a couple of buddies, we got a camp in central New Hampshire, and you're more than welcome to come up and trounce around the Big Woods and do stuff like that too, man.
Oh, I appreciate it. It's been on my list to do that muzzleloader season in New Hampshire. It falls on such a great, you know, there's not going to be snow, but I like still hunting. And there could be snow. You never know, but.
Yeah, I mean, I killed my best New Hampshire buck over there November 3rd, 3 inches of snow.
Yep, nice.
So, I mean.
It's just, I love that first, like, week of November, end of October. It's a great time for deer movement. And, yeah, it's been on my list to go to New Hampshire with the Muzzy and do it. So, yeah, maybe I'll hit you up on that this year.
Yeah, man, let me know, because it's a lot of fun. And camp's really fun. I mean, there's no bathroom. There's no electricity. We got an old shitty grill. We cook some real good food. We have a couple beers at night. We have, you know, good storytelling. And it's just, it's really fun, you know?
Those are the best camps, man.
Yeah.
You really don't need the camp. Camp is the best when you get away from your creature comforts. And
that's right.
You realize that you don't need that shit. It's you need camaraderie and good company and a wood stove, and you're all set.
That's it, man.
Yeah.
All right, buddy. Well, let's wrap this one up. I've taken up enough of your time here. It's and with the time change too, man, it's getting late, so.
That's all right.
I appreciate you coming on, and I've really enjoyed it, man.
Yeah, me too. Thanks a lot. You're doing great stuff, and we'll see you at Huntstock, buddy.
All right, boys. We'll see you on the next one.